You're about to hear the opinions, suggestions, and observations of a licensed real estate broker in California. Since each situation can be unique, do not consider anything said here as legal advice for your specific needs. Always seek out the advice of a suitable professional in your area for advice tailored to your situation. Please remember that when following advice, your results may vary. Please also understand that the information provided here is not intended to cover all aspects of the subject material, but rather a sample of issues the speaker considers important.
Ah! You seem to understand. I'm not locked in here with you.
I got this!
You're locked in here with me!
Hello, everyone! Welcome to another edition of Real Estate Realities with the Rebel Broker. My name is Robert Whitelaw, and I am the Rebel Broker. Licensed real estate broker in the state of California, member of the National Association of Realtors. Here on my increasingly intermittent real estate show. I'm not even going to apologize anymore. I do it every time. Here to give you the latest inside scoop on all things real estate related. We definitely have a few interesting things on the schedule for today. The last few weeks have been very interesting. It's been since the week before Father's Day. Father's Day was Sunday, which was why that show didn't happen. I got a little surprise from my boys, and we ended up having a father-son kind of thing going on Father's Day, which I think is appropriate. Then it was off to, I think that was the weekend I went off to take care of the vacation property in Hawaii. So we've got an update on that. Lots of interesting things. You know, there's so many interesting things when you're trying to deal with an investment property that is not right near you. And when you add on the vacation rental aspect of it, then there's a whole new level of stuff. And you quickly realize the long list of people with their handout to take your money away from you when you're trying to make this stuff work. So we'll talk about that. Of course, the shameful title of today's show, Does Size Really Matter? I'm not even going to share all the jokes that could potentially go with that. Just Google it if you like. I'm just going to glaze right over it, despite the fact we could spend an awful lot of time just making jokes about that. And it actually comes from a personal experience where I did not get a listing. I actually pride myself on being pretty good on that. When you do a listing presentation, you're basically laying out what you're going to do for that person, how you're going to help them get their property sold, all the various things you're going to do. And, you know, I try to be sensitive to people's time when I do a listing appointment. I try to whittle down the why I'm so awesome part, the whole self-promotion thing, but that's really what it's for. I'm supposed to be in there self-promoting, but instead what I like to do is promote the absolutely functional, important things that I do to help folks reach their goals, right? And as you can imagine, over the years, my listing presentation slide deck has gotten shuffled, edited. I mean, I've been doing listing appointments since 1988. You would think by now I would have given up on changing it and just gone with the one that worked the most. But I got to the point where it was working, and I thought, you know what? Maybe I can whittle a few minutes off of this so these folks can get back to their day, get this real estate person out of their house, which is what they want. From the minute a real estate agent walks in, the next thing that person wants is for the real estate agent to walk out. So in the process of whittling that down, I got rid of the slide that specifically dealt with should you be concerned when you're dealing with an agent that doesn't have a giant office behind them? And I didn't, in this particular instance, I was actually doing a list, and this is what makes it even doubly painful. I was doing a listing presentation for a friend. Someone had called me. They own a property. There's three. They had inherited it. Their mom had passed away. And each of them had a real estate agent they liked. One of them had been a client of mine in a past deal a few years ago, and also a guy I worked with in the past when I was doing some high tech stuff. But he wasn't really the deciding brother. His brother was the deciding guy. So he was totally upfront with me. He said, "Hey, we're going to be talking to three different agents, one that each of the siblings likes, and then we're going to pick." So I went in there and I gave a very annotated version. I went far more functional, right? I didn't actually even sit down and do the "Here's why I'm awesome" presentation. I went in there saying, "Here are three different options on how to manage this property. It was one that needed a ton of work, and it could potentially be very profitable if they're willing to do a lot of renovation to the property before selling it. But then there would also be the delay, and I'm not 100% optimistic about where the market's going. So I'm not sure when things may or may not decline in certain areas. So I was sort of suggesting a middle of the road approach that would get it on the market as soon as possible to allow at least the fundamental changes that needed to happen." So I was much more troops on the ground focused, much more "Here's how to sell it" versus "Here's me" in the introductory part, right? "Here's why I'm good. Here's why I'm great. Here's why you shouldn't worry about X, Y, and Z." And so as I guess a shout out to other agents out there, always be mindful of things relating to you that might cause a potential client to pause and wonder for a moment, "Wow, you know, they don't have this. Should that worry me?" In this case, it's that I'm not part of a big office. I'm not. It's my office. I have two agents who work under me. I have other folks that I use on a consultation kind of basis. I do use, depending on the kind of transaction it is, I'll use escrow coordinators. So there's a variety of folks I use, but they're invisible. I don't expose my clients to those folks. I'm it. I'm the one throat for my clients. So one of the things I do deal with in my little presentation is teams versus not teams. That's not today's show, but the short answer to that one is you as the client should never even know there's a team, right? Whether or not there's a team should be immaterial to you. It should be stuff is getting done, and when you dial one person, you always get the latest information, right? That's the client-focused way. The big push that they do on the translation, and this is a sad fact, but the sad translation for most agents I know that really tout their quote-unquote team is really saying to you, "Listen, you know what? I'm all about getting the listing. So I'm always out there hustling to get the next client to sign on the bottom line for a listing. I'm not about managing the process of getting your stuff accomplished on a day-to-day basis. So I have people I pay to do that. So you're not getting any of my years experience. You're getting a boilerplate manufacturing line approach to your escrow or your sale of your home or whatever is going on. And I'm kind of off really getting the next client. Once I've got you, I'm done with you until I get my check based on what you're doing. But I'm really kind of going for the next person." And I know that's not universally true, but it sure as heck is common enough that it's worth keeping in your head. So maybe that's a whole other show, but let's talk about office size for a second and discuss, is it important today? Has it ever really been important? What are the circumstances where you absolutely should go with an agent who's part of a big office versus not? We can discuss all that. So that'll be a big part of today's show. Another thing I want to talk about, as I said, is the vacation rental update. Give you an idea of what's going on there. As of today, I am about 5 days behind on my plan. It's taking me a little bit longer than I had thought to get my merchant account. Let's just discuss the vacation rental thing right now. I actually have notes today. I frequently don't do notes. I used to do notes all the time. I found a book with my old notes going all the way back to, does anyone really care about this information? This is a list going all the way back to, some of these I don't even put the date on. Here's when dated 2009. So it's been, this particular book's been in the cupboard a while. Let's see. I also want to talk about, I don't want to forget, this is why I wrote it down, contradictions in the market that I'm seeing that are kind of concerning. We've got a couple of interesting articles about what the markets are doing. Are we seeing another real estate bubble percolating? What's really amazing is I came across an article written by Housing Wire, which really comes close to where my feelings have been on the marketplace, which kind of blew me away, because that does not happen horribly frequently. But so let's go ahead and talk about staging. So, you know, we talked a couple of shows. In fact, the last stage I did, I think, was about staging, right? So I kind of sort of took my own advice. And my parents have decided they're going to move. They are going to move about 150 yards from where they currently live. They're going to stay in the exact same community. They've just found a place that's bigger. And it'll fill their needs. It can be the last move ever that they ever need to take, right? This will allow them to have a live-in caretaker once they get to that age if needed. So it's got room for them, all of their junk, plus another person and their junk if needed, when the time comes that their mobility declines or they need folks to come in and fix meals for them or whatever they might need. So, and they've gotten to an age where this kind of stuff scares them. And I'm still young enough that I don't think you're doing it right if you're not at least a little bit scared from time to time. So there was a big question that the people who are selling this house are fantastic. They love my parents. They love the idea of them moving in and taking over their home. And then those folks are going to move to Reno, Nevada. So they ask me now, I've mentioned my father is also a real estate person. He got into the business after I did. He is 10 years younger than me in real estate years. So I give him a hand every now and then with a little. I'm sure if he's listening to the show, he's going to totally smack me for even implying this. But so, you know, sometimes he'll defer to me for information on relating to real estate. And in this particular occasion, they wanted me to come over and do a staging walkthrough with them. And so we did that. This actually happened on, why were we there? Oh, I had just gotten back from Hawaii. I believe it was 4th of July. But anyway, so we did the walkthrough thing. And I said, this needs to go. This needs to go. You need to, and it was all stuff we had talked about, right? So it was all very mainstream. It was, you need to get rid of this stuff. You need to clear off this shelf and only have two items on it. All your photo albums need to go away. All of these need to go away. This furniture needs to go away. Now, as a realtor guy, broker dude, there's got to be a better phrase than broker dude, broker boy, broker guy. Yeah, I'll come up with something. The great thing about doing what I do is I don't have to do it, right? If I come into your house and I say, that's got to go, that's got to go, that's got to go, this over here's got to go, do this here. Those are usually homework items for my clients, right? Or if they don't want to do it, we can hire someone to come in and do it. I usually don't do it. However, when you go through your parents' house and you say, here's all the stuff you need to do, and you give them a list, unfortunately, they can then turn around and say, well, when will you be coming back to do all that? That's what happened to me. So I think for the first few seconds in my head, I was going, holy free holies, how am I going to get out of this? I think at some point I realized it ain't going to happen. Then I realized I have three strapping sons, and I thought, hey. And I have a pickup truck because every self-respecting man has a pickup truck. The next day, I got to go pick up all their junk and take it to storage. Two or three loads later, the funny thing is they're moving 150 yards, but I had to drive 12 miles to put this stuff into storage. Now, one reason why I'm telling this story is because, like a lot of folks, my parents have overstuffed their house. They have a lot of stuff in there that makes a big space feel super small. So there was a lot of stuff that needed to go. And the other thing is, my mother is a artsy type, sort of. In her older years, she discovered making things out of ceramics. So she's like paints it, and some of this stuff is like comes out of a mold, and she puts the clay into a mold, and then they put in a kiln, and all, you know, she does all these things, right? And she has made a great many wonderful and delightful things. I have a little incense burner thing sitting right here on my desk I'm using at this moment, made by my mother. So don't misunderstand. A, I love my mommy. B, I totally encourage all of her artistic instincts and in no way suggest she stop. However, she has created this little ceramic family that sits on this built-in buffet thing that is just rock solid nightmare fuel. It's you have to see it to believe it, you know. And I went there yesterday and actually took the home photos for the listing, and I was adamant about moving those things out of the photos because I didn't want to turn into an internet meme. You know how they've got like the girl climbing out of the well, or they've got Slender Man in the woods? It would be creepy ceramic family on the shelf. That's what it would be. And one of them's got these crazy dead eyes that are just big round circles, and the pupils right there in the middle. Just creepy. Creepy. And of course, I shared this opinion with my mother, and she disagreed with me. So sadly, the ceramic family of psychopathic murderers is still on the shelves of her house. And that just goes to show you how little influence I can truly have, right? So I go in there and I do all that. And they moved most of the furniture I said we should move. And frankly, once it was discovered I was going to be the one moving the furniture, I maybe wasn't quite as enthusiastic about suggesting we move some of the other furniture that probably could have stood a move. But she's got this corner buffet thing that is just packed to the gills with tchotchkes, all kinds of stuff, right? There's Marilyn Monroe in there. There's Elvis in there. There's the San Francisco cable car thing, little crystal figurines. There's just tons and tons and tons of stuff. And I said, I need you to whittle that down. So there's just 2 to 3 items max on each shelf. You need airspace between each thing. And you need to get all the junk off the top. All that's got to go. So last week we moved all the big stuff and got them boxes so they could box up stuff. Came back yesterday. All the tchotchkes are right where they were. Not a single one of them moved. Not one. All the family albums still sitting right there. My mother refused. She's, nope, those are staying. Those aren't going anywhere. Those are going to be right there. People will love those. I said, Mom, not everyone is as big of a Betty Boop fan as you are. Just going to say, you know, it's not like I've been doing this for 25 years or anything. You think my mother would, you know, you'd think my mom would at least support me in what I do, but no. So there's that. But even with that, a lot of the things not getting done that I still think should have been done, place looks amazing. You know, once you, and particularly their front living room, right? And they were stunned at how good the place looked themselves. You know, once you get down to it and you start getting the things out of your space, it blows you away how much room there actually is. So I think that the probability of this thing selling super quick has quadrupled. And I think that just in what they've done so far, would I have done more? Yeah. She also has, they have a really lovely deck that overlooks a mountain range. They live in the Santa Cruz Mountains. But she has potted plants on every square inch of the area right in front of the rail. So that foot between the rail and the rest of the deck is all taken up with potted plants going all the way around. That's not everybody's thing, right? And it also makes that deck feel ridiculously small. Couldn't get any headway there either. They refuse to move any of that stuff because they say they have to water it and take care of it. So I get that. Compromises were made, maybe not as many as I would have liked, but at least we got it into a good space. And what's amazing, it's almost like the universe was telling them this is the way it's supposed to go. Their neighbor from two doors down wants to buy it so that the wife can move into it. And so they're all hot to do it. So this is looking really good for them. It may end up just happening, and that would be fantastic. So the staging and the photos may end up having nothing to do with it, but I have a hunch once this thing hits the market, it's going to hit the market tomorrow or Tuesday. And I think it'll go really well. And I think that the staging will have a huge impact on how long it takes to get the place sold. It all needs to get sold before it needs to get sold within 30 to 60 days. So I am fairly optimistic that's going to happen. It's a very unique property, and the staging really accentuated some of its best features. So I just wanted to throw that out there, some actual practical experience of not only me telling somebody what to do to stage their home, but then me actually having to jump in and do it. So, and it's absolutely an expense worth taking on. It's costing them $210 a month for the storage facility. That may be ridiculous for some other parts of the country. That's kind of the going rate here in crazy town, Northern California. Totally worth it, though. The amount of time it's going to save them, the amount of additional eyes it's going to get, the potential increased number of offers, I think absolutely has made that a worthwhile expense for them. And the best part is they got a slightly larger storage unit. So as time goes on, hopefully I can whittle away at their souls and get them to put some more tchotchkes and photo albums into the storage facility. And you know what? My mom... When I confronted her about the photo albums, she said, "Well, I want to make sure they're safe, and you know, I don't want them, and I don't want to, you know, they could get stolen or anything like that." I didn't really want to fight too hard, but the only thing that will never get stolen from your house are your family albums. They're the most valuable thing to you and the least valuable thing to everyone else, for a variety of reasons. One, nobody else gives a rat's butt about what your family looks like or looked like. And B, nothing ties a thief to a crime scene better than having in their possession photos of the people they stole from. And I, you know, I'm thinking the next time I talk with her, I'm going to try and approach it from the standpoint of, does your house have a fire suppression system built in? No. Well, you know what? The storage facility does. Does your house constantly have one big metal door preventing access to it that has a padlock on it? No? Okay. To get into your community, do you need a magic code to get the door to open? No, people just drive right in. Sounded like the storage facility might be a little safer there, Mom. Maybe you should always keep your photo albums in storage and just go there and want and look at them in the storage facility. So maybe I'll try that one. I suggest, I'm guessing it won't work. My smart alecky stuff doesn't work so much on my mom, but it's probably one of the reasons why she loves me so much. Okay. So that was the staging update, where I actually had to do my own staging, or my mother's staging, and my father's staging. Let's go ahead and jump into the vacation rental update. You know, I'm still of the opinion, I think, that a vacation rental is probably not your go-to first experience as a landlord. However, if the opportunity presents itself, it's hard to suggest you skip it because you're afraid. There's a lot of weird challenges. There's a lot of things you're going to have to do. It's less challenging if you live near it, so you can manage it yourself. I've hit on a lot of funky things that are Hawaii related. Number one, I don't live in Hawaii. So I have to have, and by law in Hawaii, I have to have a local emergency contact person. I'm not allowed to tell them to call me, and then I can call the plumber or the electrician or the whatever guy who needs to come out and fix stuff. Which, you know, I'm not sure my physical presence makes a difference, but on the flip side, it is 3 hours earlier there than it is here. So the idea of them having something happen at 9 o'clock and me getting a call at midnight is not something I, in terms of wanting to pay someone else to deal with the daily headaches, I'm pretty much down with that on just about any vacation rental, because it's happening all the time. And if you've got a life where you're doing other things and you've got a job, probably having a local property manager or at least a contact person to manage the property, an emergency contact, is a good thing. As I mentioned, in the state of Hawaii, they charge a huge amount of money for vacation rentals. The typical number was 35%. I managed to find someone who charged a little bit less, and then for anything that any renters they get, and then they charge even less for renters I get. So my goal is to be responsible for 90%+ of the folks who rent. I've also continued my, and this is something you need to consider as well. Do not let yourself get paralyzed by analysis. I think a lot of times what you're going to find is start with good enough. Right. I think one of my problems is, and this is something when it comes to my personal stuff, I tend to do this. I tend to get paralyzed by analysis. And at some point I have to slap myself and remind myself, hey, you know what? Right now it's good enough. I'm not doing anything that is so set in stone. I can't change it down the road. Let's get this thing actively rented. So I created a schedule based on that. I let myself get too tied up with analyzing all the various options for me to take payment for Visa and MasterCard. And I was analyzing this provider versus this provider. And I realized, you know what? Here's an easy path. The charges they're going to invoke are very reasonable. Let's just get going with that. It's not like I sign a year contract with these people. It's a month-to-month thing. If I decide they stink and I want to go with somebody else, I can do that in less than 30 days. So don't let yourself get paralyzed by this. Don't let it be the excuse for you to not move forward, because you know what? All that does is cost you money, because while this place isn't rented, I'm still having to pay the rent or the mortgage. I'm still having to pay for the power bill. I'm still having to pay the water bill, paying all the phone bill, everything. So the only way you get that stuff paid not out of your pocket is if you've got folks renting it. So it's important for there to be the decision and then the fastest way to get things going, and then just do it. And of course, the other long pole for me was analyzing the best tools to use. Now, the site's actually up. I finished it yesterday. I was actually hoping to finish it right when I got back from Hawaii. But again, 4th of July, and then my parents ended up needing me to move stuff. So the time I had allotted for them, for the site and for finishing up the Hawaii stuff, ended up getting handed off and donated to my parents. So that was the one reason for the big delay. Which isn't really that big of a delay, I guess. But if you head on over to robertsrentals.us or roberts.rentals, you can see the site. Let me make sure I'm sure it's up there. I finished it. But it's got all the latest photos. I've got a few more tweaks bouncing around in my head. Yeah, it looks pretty good. I'm thinking my front page is a little bit too wordy. But I think it looks good. So right now, the only way you can book a trip is using PayPal. As I said, I am still fussing around with merchant accounts and whatnot. All that paperwork got submitted yesterday. So I'm hoping early next week, like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, that it'll be up and going so people can use Visa and MasterCard. I'll turn off the PayPal option, I think, because PayPal costs a little more for me to use. And then I think I'll probably also accept checks if people want to write a check directly, as long as it clears with some amount of days before they're going to arrive. You know, that kind of thing. But the pictures are great. I went over there with my higher quality camera and took a few shots of the place. I think they show really well. And it shows the place for what it is. It's a really just a nice, basic place to call home while you're on the islands, and to be able to have a central location where you can go off and experience all the fun stuff that Hawaii has to offer, that the island of Oahu has to offer. So, and as I promised this audience, I'm going to go ahead and at some point create a discount code so that you can go on there, use the discount code, get a discount only to folks who rent it for a week. So you'll have to do a 7-day rental. Minimum is 3 days. But for a 1-week rental, I'll give you some kind of a discount, maybe like a day free kind of thing or something like that. But we'll figure out. It'll be good enough that you'll think, yeah, that's a decent amount of money. At least enough for you to maybe go out and take a couple people out to dinner on me, so to speak. In terms of just other stuff, so there are a lot of ways for you to promote your rental property without having to do what I did. I mean, I created my own website because I wanted to be able to have absolute control over how it gets presented and do a lot of other things. You don't necessarily have to do that. Now, one other thing I'm going to be doing is using a site called VRBO.com, and that's vacation rental something. I don't know what the BO part is, or maybe vacation rental something online is probably what it stands for. And that's the number one site for rentals, but it costs 300 and something bucks a year, or you can go with some sort of a model where they keep a certain percentage of each time it rents on their site. So if you think you're going to be renting frequently, you know, probably doing the year thing is smart. That's what I'm going to do. But it'll be up there. And if I do end up getting a rental through VRBO, unfortunately, they will take that. They'll, you know, if I did it the other way, they would take a piece of the action. If I can somehow get folks to be booking directly from my website, though, then I will be in a much better position to be able to make a little bit more on each rental. Then I can save it. I can either buy down the loan on that or put it into account to upgrade the unit. There's a lot of things I want to do. There's new flooring. There's a kitchen work I want to do. There's bathroom work I want to do. There's a lot of little things I want to do. And that's something else I encourage people to do when they're starting out. My plan is not to take out any of the cash that comes in from this rental and use it for other things. I want to pour it right back into this property. The number one goal is to pay off the mortgage. I don't have a very substantial mortgage on the property, but I'd love to get rid of it. As a monthly expense, I would love it to go away. It's very cheap money, though, so I'm not sure from a leverage standpoint if it makes a lot of sense to over-aggressively pay that off, but it does make sense to save the money so at the end of each year I've got enough saved up to do some work on the property. Now, here's something else. Some folks can get a rental property, and they really don't have to worry about much for a really long time, but while I was there, I was replacing light switches, light sockets, The single greatest goal of nature in Hawaii is to destroy everything made by man. So the remote control for the television set stopped working because of the salt air. You know, you got to worry about humidity. You got to worry about that moisture. You got to worry about mold. So you've got all these things that can potentially really screw with you. And I'll tell you, more than most other properties, when it comes to a property like this, if it's in a tropical environment, I'm going to suggest you put a lot more money in the fix-it account because the probability of stuff going wonky just because it does, just because it's rusted or just because it's just because it's in that tropical environment is escalated. So this would apply to just about anybody. If you've got a rental property in Florida, you're facing the exact same kind of things. Coastal Louisiana, same things. Coastal Texas, same things, right? These are all the same kind of elements that could affect just about any kind of a vacation rental property that's going to have a lot of exposure to a more tropical, hot, humid, moist environment where everything from TVs, DVRs, refrigerators, ovens, microwaves, toasters, coffee makers, light switches, plugs, everything is constantly being assaulted by the elements. So you're going to want to think to yourself, what kind of an environment is this unit in? And instead of if typically for a rental in that area, someone would put aside 5% or 10% of what they're making. And of course, it depends. Sometimes people put a flat amount aside to save up for repairs. I know when I was renting my personal home, I was putting aside $75 a month just to replace stuff, whether it meant doing work on plumbing or a toilet or a refrigerator or a washer or a dryer, a window, something happens with a door, whatever. For my money, it was more than I needed to, because when everything was said and done, that money was still in the bank. But I wanted to have it there in case I needed it. In an environment like this, I'm looking at putting aside probably $100 a month to $125 a month just for the idea of I'm going to have to be servicing stuff. I think that's probably more. I think the $75 actually would probably work, because that was an overestimation of what I needed for dealing with stuff here. But you never want to have your rental unit be something where you're pulling money out of your personal funds. You want it to be self-supporting. So I'm going to suggest for the first year, until you've sussed out all the various expenses for at least the first year, don't take a dime out of that. Let it accumulate its money. That way you can absolutely see, you can always, of course, from an accounting standpoint, see what it made you. But it's nice at the end of the year to say, hey, wow, I've got $1,000 in the bank. It was just made by this. It's all positive cash flow for me. That's great. Now, hopefully it's going to be a lot more than $1,000 at the end of the year. But you want to have it, just have it be there just in case. I think it's good to play that first year safe. Let's go ahead and jump into the primary topic today. Does size really matter in real estate in terms of real estate offices? And let's talk about the history a little bit here of real estate offices. Now, of course, way back in the olden days, when I first got into real estate, now my grandfather was in the business since a little bit after World War II, and then he stopped. I think he probably stopped doing real estate while I was in high school, so sometime in the early 80s. And you know, he used to tell me how things worked back then. And as time has gone on, the importance of being part of a large office has dwindled. Right? When I the very first day I started, there was, you used to get every week, I can't remember if it was every week or every month, but I think it was every week, you would get a book of all the current listings on this really, what felt like recycled cheap paper, but it would be all, occasionally there'd be, I think I seem to recall there being photos in some of those books, but it would be like one photo, it'd be like a front photo of the property. And then the rest of it was just text. And the super high-tech thing that we had in the office at that time, we had one room where there were two or three little keyboards that had a thermal printer as part of it. And you could type in your search criteria, all text-based, no maps, no nothing. And it could take you forever to create a search string. You might have to break out the map and figure out coordinates and do all this weird stuff. And then when it would print out, it wouldn't print out any pictures. It would just print out text of the properties. That was the multiple listing service. That was how you got access to all those things. Now, if you were someone in Chicago trying to find a house in San Francisco, well, how would you do that? There's no internet back then. There was kind of sort of an internet, right? But it was between universities, and there was no internet in terms of websites. And there were absolutely, so there was no other way. You had, if you wanted to find a house in another city, you needed someone who knew that area. Now, you could either call information, tell a city, and try to, if you had the name of a real estate agent, or you could do the easy thing. You could say, well, you know what? I know that Century 21 or Better Homes and Gardens or Prudential or whatever has offices all across the country. So by becoming part of their network during that time, you could get access to other areas. It was the only way to do it. One of the big things that was a draw, and I was part of a big office in those days. And one of the big draws that they said, the way to draw you in, the reason why you wanted to join a bigger office, was you were likely to get internal referrals from people who were moving to that area from out of the country or out of the state or out of the region. Well, as time has gone on, the importance of that has gotten less and less. So once we started having the MLS on the internet, once people could do searches, I can now search for a home in any location in the country. I don't need to be part of the Century 21 network. I don't need to be part of the Better Homes and Gardens network or the Prudential network. In fact, if anything, the likelihood is that what I see will be more limited than enhanced by being in those groups. When I've got completely freewheeling access to all the homes listed through realtor.com, and that's what that is. Realtor.com basically sucks all of its data from all of the various MLS systems across the country. If you want to see my area, you could go to mlslistings.com, and that's my area. That is the exact same database that I pull from when I'm doing a search for you. Now, I have a little bit more dynamic access. I can do a little bit more creative things in terms of searches to set up for you so that you can find the right home. But all of the big reasons to join a big office have really gone away in terms of achieving your goal. Now, so in terms of them having a national or international network, maybe the international side, and the only company I've ever been involved with that I think kind of does this is in the high end international market where you've got Sotheby's real estate, which does a lot of international stuff. But even then, that's such a corner market that for the typical buyer that I deal with, who's moving from San Jose to Morgan Hill, or who's moving from Chicago to Morgan Hill, or whatever they're doing, that doesn't even come close to being part of the equation that those folks are thinking about. So the number one thing that they brought to the table was their networks, because there was no other way for people to connect. There was no other way for people to see things in other communities or talk to agents. Well, that doesn't exist anymore. So what about the other thing? They offer a sheer number of agents. Now, is that something that you should consider important? Well, not really. Agents in offices can cooperate, but tend not to. Agents tend to not cooperate with other agents because they don't want to give up any of their commission to another agent. If I'm an agent in an office, if I've managed to really make friends with another agent, I may have some sort of agreement with them. Well, I will cover for them and they will cover for me. And there may not be any payment of commissions, but that's super, super rare. So no matter what they do, they're giving up some chunk of their commission to the person that they work with. Agents hate that. It's a very competitive business. Even agents that are quote unquote friends oftentimes are not quite as friendly as you and I would understand as a friendship. So the idea that somehow you're getting more bang for the buck because there's more agents there really doesn't go. It really doesn't give you what you're thinking that it gives you. Okay, well, what about more brokers being involved? More brokers serving as resources for those agents in cases where they need some information. Well, that doesn't really fly either. After having been involved with a number of large offices, I found most of the time my broker A was not horribly available for me to ask questions. And when I did have questions, they would refer me to something that I had access to independently of them and that had nothing to do with that office. So, and this isn't me beating up any particular individual or office. This is the way it was in all the big offices I've worked at. I've worked at three or four big national or international chains. And the reason why I am not with one now is because I just didn't see the value add. There was nothing there. The only thing that some of these big offices have to offer is ease for the agent. In other words, as a broker, if I wanted to go and hang my shingle up at an office, I could do it. They'd probably charge me $300 a month. And I could probably work out a deal where I'm paying very little of my commission. And what I would get would be an office I could go to so I could use the conference room, but that'd really be it. Now, and I have been an agent now for a very long time. I've been on my own now for a pretty good amount of time, almost 10 years. It's been 10 years. I've had my own office where I rented my own office space as a business owner. And once I got to the point where it had been 18 months where I did not need to take a single client to the office, I had it all set up and ready to go. I used it very rarely personally to just go sit and do work. Never had to use the conference room in the course of 18 months. So I finally just got rid of it. Everybody wanted to meet at the Starbucks. Everyone wanted to meet at the property, you know, and the other part of it was, is I could talk to a local escrow company or title company and use one of their conference rooms in a pinch if needed. So if you're listening, you're hearing that there's really nothing currently buyer or seller related that gives you a big bang for the buck. Now, there's a bug. In fact, the only things that I'm seeing happening with bigger offices, which kind of in my book fits in as a sort of scam, is because of the way the market's working right now, what a lot of offices are encouraging is for their agents to take very low commission rates, but then get exclusive listings or pocket listings out of it. And what that means is that your property doesn't go onto the multiple listing service. So now the benefits that a lot of people seem to associate with being with a larger office are actually completely turned on their head. Instead of getting general exposure to everybody who looks at the MLS, which is hundreds of thousands of eyes, probably millions of eyes, now you're only getting exposed to whatever clients are currently working with the agents in that office. This is not a good deal for sellers. What equals a good deal for sellers is the largest number of eyeballs on your property so that you get multiple offers. You may get multiple offers by going to, say, the largest office in your town that has the largest number of agents. They all have certain buyers they're working with, but the brokerage is willing to take a lower commission because they'll end up making as much as they would have if they put it on the MLS and then had to split that brokerage with another office. Does that make sense? So in other words, let's say someone comes to you and says, you know what, I will take a 4% commission on listing and selling your property, but only if you let us do it as a pocket listing. And then 2% of the commission will go to whoever brings the buyer, and 2% will go to whoever brings the seller. Now, the goal of your agent is to bring both and double end the deal. Your broker is double ending it no matter how you slice it. Remember, a real estate agent has to work under a broker. So if it's all happening within their office, they may be splitting that 4% with the agents who are involved, but the office itself is keeping it. So a lot of offices have a rule. You can't take a 4% listing or under a 5%, or there's different rules for different offices, but many of them will say you can't take they won't permit their agents to take a lower interest rate, a lower commission rate, unless it's a pocket listing. In that equation, the only person who gets screwed is the seller, right? So this whole idea of going with the bigger office, particularly if you're willing to agree to having a pocket listing, will cost you more than if you go with a non-larger office. Unless you do a pocket listing with a super small office or an individual, which would be even worse. My suggestion is to never do a pocket listing, never agree to a pocket listing. No one has ever brought to me a scenario that made sense in terms of doing the best thing for your client. Now, are there clients who ask for a pocket listing who want to simplify the process and are willing to sacrifice dollars for convenience? Maybe they don't want a sign on the property. They want to be very discreet. Now, I've done listings like this before. This happens when high-end properties are selling well and the market is healthy. You will occasionally find high-end folks who don't want the neighbors to know they're selling. They want to have one agent handle it. And you know what? I'll argue that even in those circumstances, you don't need to go with a large office. You're not losing anything by going with a small office. Now, I've done those. I've done those kinds of properties in the past but in those discussions with my clients, I told them, I personally am trying to make sure you understand that this is not the best way to go for you if getting top dollar is your goal. In fact, I believe there's a very high probability that you will lose potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars from what you could get if we did this using the entire MLS. That is also another reason why if you're frequently seeing stuff listed on Zillow that isn't on the MLS, or seeing stuff listed as coming soon or that kind of stuff, where that's never going to actually end up on the MLS. These are guys who are trying to sell it so that they're doing it themselves, right? So that it never even ends up in the MLS. So they're not throwing it out to all those other real estate agents out there. And I'll tell you, it's amazing. There's an entire shtick. I mean, there was a period of time where I was with a larger high-end office, and their whole thing was about selling the impression of exclusivity, right? They wanted to go for super high-end. They wanted to phrase a pocket listing like, this is you going for the luxury option. This is your top-end Mercedes choice, because you get very high touch. We're very elite, that kind of a thing. And they actually managed to get an awful lot of folks to buy into that to the detriment of their own bottom line. So don't get suckered in by that kind of stuff. Now, what about other things? What about strategic partnerships with websites? Surely these bigger companies have a better ability to get higher visibility for their listings on all the associated sites out there that show things. No, absolutely not true. In fact, My argument is that today, the most critical decision is the individual real estate agent you pick, not the office. In all of the properties I ever sold while I've worked for offices, the real estate office did nothing. If your property is not at the ridiculous extreme of listings they have, you're not going to get that high exposure ad in a newspaper, which is what the companies I worked for did. Everyone vied for getting their property in the office ad in the local newspaper. Well, no one cares about that crap anymore. When was the last time you went and picked up a local paper to look for a house? Probably not too recently. It's probably been a very, very long time since you did that. So what about those strategic relationships? Well, all of those websites, if you wanted to cover the top five websites, the only way you can do that and cover it ridiculously is with an agent who does it, not an office. An office simply cannot guarantee a high level of exposure for all of the listings that that office takes. They just can't do it. Who can? The individual agent who pays for that level of exposure. Now, I'm not advertising at that level anymore, but I used to have the absolute highest level of advertising possible on Zillow, the absolutely highest level of advertising possible on Trulia, and by correlation, I had Yahoo Real Estate because Yahoo Real Estate gets all of its stuff from Zillow, and that just inherited all my stuff. All of the big sites on realtor.com, I've got the highest level exposure you can get. An office cannot get it, but an agent can get it. So there is absolutely nothing that an office or international real estate firm can give you in terms of benefits. In fact, there's things that only the agent can give you. So the discussion needs to stop being, I need to pick the right office. No, there is no right office. There is nothing an office has to do with this that's going to make things better for you as a buyer or a seller. It is strictly picking the right agent. Now, if you're concerned that your agent doesn't have enough backup, that concern is just as valid whether they're in a big office or a small office. In fact, I'm willing to bet that I have far more backup than 99% of agents in a big office. The closest I came to backup in my offices was having access to the boilerplate papers and being able to bind them into a spiral binder with the equipment that was in the office. So basically what they were giving me that I didn't have was access to about $80 worth of equipment from Staples. Which brings home my core point of when you're doing something in real estate, what your focus needs to be on is the real estate agent that you select, not the office. If the office has some sort of great incentive thing, fantastic. I mean, I suppose that can happen. But in terms of getting your home sold, getting the highest level exposure, getting the highest dollar amount, it's far more important to focus on your agent than it is on the office. In fact, I will say categorically right now, aside from having a office space that can seat X number of agents, there is no national or international real estate firm that can provide more than I can provide in terms of the stuff that matters most in getting your home sold or helping you find the right home and purchasing it at the best possible price. There is nothing that they do. Anything that relates to their specific networks that they do is so minuscule that the advantage it would give you would be less than a percent, far less than a percent. Those networks simply just don't work anymore. They don't do anything. They don't accomplish anything. In fact, I would argue that there are far more negatives being associated with a large office than there are positives. Remember, the bias of this is that I am a small office. I've been both. I've made choices to be part of both at different times and different times of my career. The reason I got my broker's license was so I didn't have to be part of someone else's office anymore. I could go off and do my own thing. And I've discussed this in nauseating detail in past shows. I've got a certain philosophy that I want followed. And I was unable to find an office that came close. So I started doing my own thing. And that's it. Now, some advantages to you as a consumer with a smaller office, particularly if you're dealing with the broker, to be really honest, they've got more elbow room in terms of money to give you a discount. Like, let me give you an example. I have tons of buyers now, and you know, I realize we're never supposed to reveal weakness. You know, as realtors, everything's supposed to always be going fantastic. I am having, I'm coming up on the worst year I've had in probably 8 or 9 years. In terms of on the ground activity, escrows, that type of stuff, I've got referrals that are out that are doing things, but in terms of just going back on 12 months of income generated, having a terrible year. A huge amount of that is because I was so lopsided in my marketing, excuse me, towards buyers. I have tons of buyers right now that are still looking for homes that have been looking since this time last year. We've made offers on places. We've got in multiple offer situations where they didn't get accepted. Prices have been going up. Some of my folks are reevaluating where they can shop, what they're looking for. So what I did, in addition to shifting my marketing more towards sellers, what I've also done, and because I have the ability to do this because I'm a broker, I am now offering a $2,000 rebate to any buyers who purchase a home. If you're currently one of my buyers, when escrow closes, I will rebate $2,000 of my commission back to you. Some conditions apply. You know, that it can't result in me making zero. So it obviously has to do with how much the overall commission is. But I'm offering that as an incentive, and I emailed all of my buyers and said, you know, I realize interest rates have been fluctuating. For some of you, they're not in a great position. I realize prices have been working against us in a lot of cases. So here's my way of at least giving you a little bit of income to work with once escrow closes. When it does close, I'll write you a check for $2,000. And that can translate into things for you. If you're someone who you know you're working with a broker who works for themselves, you can say, hey, you know, how would you feel about rebating a little bit of your commission back to me? Can we talk about that? On listings, right, with a broker, because I'm not, most agents are giving 25% of their commission to their broker. Well, as a broker myself, and having had to deal with that, that seems to me that as a seller, if an agent comes in and says, you know, we want to do a 6% listing, you could try and negotiate that down by a few points, simply because that broker has more flexibility. Now, as the broker, I get to decide. As a real estate agent, there are certain limitations placed on agents, and that they're not allowed to take listings at below a certain percentage point. I know, I hate to admit this, it's been so long since I've signed up a new agent, but I have a limit on my agents on how low they can take a commission at. I think I have a number in there, and I think I even have in there that I can verbally approve. So I don't put this huge, you have to get a signature to approve it kind of thing, because I want to give them some negotiation elbow room. But when you're dealing with the broker themselves, there's more room. There's more room to move around because there's not as many people taking a piece of the pie on the broker's end. Right? If it was just me, it would be me splitting the money with myself. So it gives you as a seller or a buyer a little bit more flexibility. So in terms of having a little bit more wiggle room to walk away from a transaction with a little bit more money, your smaller offices, you're working with an independent broker, that is where you're going to get your biggest advantage as a buyer or a seller. Now, in terms of amount of technology that's used, you know, one problem is that large offices get locked into a system they buy. If an agent works for a large office, they're paying X amount of dollars per month, and part of that is supposed to cover this infrastructure that's been created by the brokerage to allow them to do business. So it's a way for them to keep track of clients. It's a way for them to do auto emails to clients. It's maybe even a escrow tracker and all kinds of other web-based things. Well, I'll tell you what, that stuff gets put in place and it's there for years and years and years. I review my technology every year. So I now offer heads and shoulders above what anybody from a big office offers, because most of their systems are the same ones I left when I stopped working with large offices in 2005. Or excuse me, 2000 and what is it? I came back from Hawaii. I came back from England, and then I worked for a big office for about a year. I know for a fact the system they currently use, that they used when I left in 2007. I got my broker's license in 2002, 2003. did my own thing while I was overseas, then went to a large local office. The system that they use now is the same system that I left in 2007, 2008, when I came back and stayed with them for a little while. So no technological advancements in almost 10 years. And on my own, I've incrementally embraced new technologies every year that I've been in business. So while that large company has seen zero changes to the infrastructure they offer and the way they manage properties, mine has seen six. That's a big difference. Now, is everyone as aggressive as I am in terms of really grabbing onto the latest technology and the best ways to manage escrows and to get the word out about your properties and the market and all these other kinds of things? No. But maybe you should be looking for someone who does that in your local area. So I got to tell you, the smaller office, the individual, and this doesn't mean that a real estate agent in a larger office can't be the same way, but it means they have to embrace a lot more cost, because they not only have the cost of being in an office on a month-to-month basis, they not only have the cost of splitting their commission with their broker, they also have the cost then of having their own infrastructure that they provide. So it gives them far less flexibility in terms of them being able to give you a discounted rate on their services. No matter how you slice it, your best bet in terms of bang for the buck is typically going to be your smaller offices. And as I've said, I mean, the way I judge my business is by doing everything better than what the average is for those areas. So if a home tends to sell for 1% under asking price in an area, my goal is to sell it for more than 1% over asking price. If the days on market tends to be 40 days, well, I want to get it sold in less than 40 days. So I'm always judging myself based on what is going on in the marketplace and beating what the majority of agents are doing. And I do it consistently all the time. And I do it because of these techniques and tactics. If I was still working for a larger office, I wouldn't be able to achieve those kinds of numbers. It would be a profound limit on how much I have to spend on providing these extra ways to get people's homes in front of buyers' eyes. Okay. I think that's it in terms of stuff I had to say about the size of real estate offices. It really just, it so much needs to be on what the agent has to do for you. And my experience has now absolutely reminded me that I need to bring these kinds of concerns up. Some buyers may not ask the question when I'm talking to them, so I need to bring these potential concerns up. In terms of news that's been out there, there was a couple I wanted to hit. Home prices hit new highs in 10 states. That was a quick headline from Reality Check on CNBC. Where is the one I really liked? Here we go. So there were two articles that came out from Housing Wire from two different folks over the course of the last week. One was San Francisco exhibiting potential signs of a housing bubble. Now, we've talked on this show about what the market's doing, where things are going, and how there should be some concern about how quick prices are going up. But one other thing that we've talked about is this doesn't seem to be a nationwide thing. So many folks are pushing this idea that everything's recovering everywhere. I've talked about how employment plays into that and how a very weak employment scenario really doesn't have me very optimistic about the longevity of what we're calling a recovery, but doesn't really seem to be a solid recovery. And I came across this article, the second article, and this one's from a different writer, but it was also posted to HousingWire. It's titled, "Heads Up, There's a Housing Bubble Forming in Markets Beyond San Francisco, Denver, Dallas, Seattle, to name a few." And this was a fantastic one. I guess to be totally honest, the reason why I thought it was so fantastic is because I agreed with it. So take that for what it's worth. They first make mention of that first article I pointed out. But they basically are pointing out that this is something that in the markets where we're seeing a lot of growth in prices, there's reason to be concerned. Let's see. California home forecast models, the San Francisco Bay Area is showing some warning signs of a bubble, but goes on to quote that it is important to clarify that this is only happening in the San Francisco Bay Area, according to the report. However, Michael Sklars, who's president and CEO of Collateral Analytics, a provider of automated valuation solutions, is also quoted in the piece as saying, when discussing price bubbles, we feel that there are a few terms which are more widely used and less understood. Perhaps if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it is quite possibly a duck. Some economists and real estate observers are trying to sensationalize an issue that does not exist. I submit that many real estate and mortgage-related organizations spin the facts to persuade consumers and homebuyers and homeowners that the housing sector is recovering across the country and getting even stronger, which it is not. Now, and that's a statement that really pisses off a lot of people. Whenever I say that kind of stuff on this show, I inevitably get that agent who says you're just ignoring the numbers. When the reality is that you have to look at where the built-in bias is, right? A lot of these organizations that gives us these rosy estimations of what's going on with the real estate business are folks that have a vested interest in folks believing that to be the case. Anytime you get something from the National Association of Realtors, the California Association of Realtors, everybody wants to put the absolute brightest, most cheery spin possible on these things, because they want folks to believe it makes sense to be a real estate agent right now. They don't make money unless there's folks paying dues. Every year I cough up over $1,000 to remain a member of the National Association of Realtors. Multiply that by how many hundreds of thousands of real estate agents there are, and you realize this is a money thing. What a surprise, right? California and New York housing markets, particularly the San Francisco Bay Area and Manhattan, are not representative of what is taking place in countless markets in between. There are numerous real estate professionals I know with whom I stay in contact throughout California and elsewhere who disagree that the signs of a housing bubble are confined to the San Francisco Bay Area. Totally agree with that. I think New York is a perfect example. Now, I don't focus a lot on the New York market. I don't want to live in New York. I don't want to buy in New York. I'm not interested in New York, but I know I tweet an awful lot of stuff. Then every once in a while, I'll add an extra tag, hashtag on that to point out that this might be a little something to indicate that things aren't going quite as everyone is promoting. Now, one thing, here's something I wanted to throw out there. And I didn't bother to pull up these articles. This is actually something from a few weeks ago. This is a note I wrote down for the show I planned on doing on Father's Day, but didn't end up doing. In a contradiction in the market, right? And it's about the message you want to sell to the public versus what you do, right? So this was there were three stories in a row that came out, all relating to new home sales, right? A, new home sales were not great. They were not where folks were hoping they would be. B, the next story talked about how the confidence of the new home construction sector was high, increased according to the polls that they were taking of the new home folks. But new starts of new homes were down. Someone who builds houses is telling you, oh yes, we're very optimistic about the future of real estate, but they are not taking actions that indicate they are building more homes. Now that's a contradiction, right? Now in some areas here in Silicon Valley, these guys are building like gangbusters because this stuff is selling like crazy and they're selling for way above asking price. Things are going nuts. It feels an awful lot like the first half of the 2000s. And it scared me then and it scares me now. I had a really good handle from about 1999, 2000 till 2007 on what was wrong with lending. I felt like I had a good grip on it. I could see folks getting 110% loans on stated income. I could see folks who under previous circumstances would never have gotten a loan getting approved for a loan. I wasn't quite as fanatical about reading up all the information, but just as a participant in the system, I was observing this and I was warning people, you know, what goes up eventually comes down. I remember saying that to an awful lot of folks. Don't assume anything. You know, you really should take a very pragmatic approach here. You should not be borrowing more than you can afford. You shouldn't be borrowing based on the idea that you'll continue to get raises and you'll make more and more moving forward. I the things I'm seeing now give me the feeling that something bad has happened. I simply have less I can actually point to and say that's the reason why, with a couple of exceptions. And this article gets into that in a minute. The unemployment situation is probably the number one thing that concerns me, simply because we're acting like there's this recovery. We're already talking, and people are talking about doing subprime lending again because of these the unemployment numbers, and because of the jobs that are being created are so much less in terms of income quality, not equality, but in the quality of the income. In other words, they're low-paying jobs, and they should be. The jobs that are being created simply don't require great levels of skill. But there's already talk again of allowing people to borrow beyond their means in order to get a house. And these little articles relating to it trickle out every now and then. Every once in a while, you'll get something from the White House or something from Fannie and Freddie that indicates we need to move more into that. For a while, they were moving way towards having affordable rental type properties through some sort of government supported scheme. But these are all things that should scare you in terms of what it does to our marketplace. It's been widely reported in Denver, Dallas, Seattle, and Salt Lake, that are among other markets where home prices have outstripped income growth, which is a leading indicator of a bubble or echo bubble, as this next one will be, according to this article. I think that is a huge nugget of information to take out of this article. When home prices outstripped income growth, that is also what happened in the last bubble, right? But it was supported by this institutional thing that said subprime lending was good, as if the real estate train could never derail, right? That was sort of the attitude. They go on to say, without a vibrant economy, the housing market cannot truly recover, and the national economy is far from vibrant. The continued abysmal job market plays a huge role in keeping the national housing market from recovering. I would say it is in the top two most influential reasons why we're not seeing more people stepping up. Because given the fact that we have such low inventory still, we should have way more buyers. If we were in a recovery, there should be way more buyers out in this marketplace. The continued abysmal job market plays a huge role in keeping the national housing market from recovering. Although, and this is one we've talked about here, although the official unemployment rate is below 6% is widely touted as proof of a resurgent economy, the sad truth is that 62.6% workforce participation rate, as reported by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is lower than it has been in several decades and near its lowest point since the end of World War II. This artificially drives down the unemployment rate, giving us this sort of soft, glowing impression of what's actually happening with unemployment. Let's see. They talk about the baby boomers playing into that percentage, but only partially so. I think it plays so little of a role that it's probably not even worth making a big deal about. In addition to massive numbers of baby boomers retiring each month, many of the jobs that have been created over the past 7 years have been lower paying and or part-time jobs. Discretionary income for so many in this country today is nearly non-existent. Now, if this were true, if we were seeing baby boomers retiring in mass, right, and leaving the workforce, and they're not, these would be getting given up to people coming up the ranks as good paying jobs, but they're not. So I just don't think the number of baby boomers that are retiring is quite as large as they seem to be implying here. Discretionary income for so many in this country today is nearly non-existent. With more than 1,000 benefit and entitlement programs to choose from, millions of Americans have decided it isn't worth looking for a job today. Stagnant wages and lower paying jobs for millions of Americans do not translate into purchasing power, especially as it relates to housing. And while demand for housing in certain markets is combined with shrinking inventories to drive housing prices up to pre-financial and housing crisis levels in some markets, without more potential homebuyers entering the housing market because of stricter lending guidelines, rising interest rates, and other factors, there begins to be a shrinking market of move-up buyers. This eventually drives prices down from bubble-induced levels. With another national election cycle upon us, it is expected that we will see an increase in media reports painting a rosy picture relative to the economy in general and the housing sector in particular. No doubt more stories will point to anomalies such as the one in San Francisco. But beyond the spin, there will be growing signs that a housing bubble is once again forming across America. And I got to tell you, I absolutely agree with this. I think that the economic things that happen are driving it that way. And I think that what's going to happen is the government is going to try to forestall it with programs. They're going to try to prevent it from happening. And in so doing, will simply make it worse when it does happen. Yeah, that's my happy news for the day. I'm just not – right now I am still myself shopping for properties. I'm absolutely looking for good deals. I am not willing to pay some elevated amount of money for a property. Which leaves me looking in some areas I may not have looked in before. But I tell you, it's not going to – eventually, these prices have to go back down. They simply can't sustain where they are. We would have to see a dramatic increase in just jobs in general for that to happen. And, of course, I live in Crazy Town, so other areas of the country aren't doing this. There are a few, but they all tend to be – tech related in one way or another, or it seems to be driven a lot by those kinds of things. But we'll have to see how things go. I can't point to specific things and say, here's the red light, here's the thing you need to watch for. And then we've got other news, the international type stuff with Greece. If Greece takes the absolute nosedive that it off and on seems that it's going to do, that's a first domino for a lot of things. Keep your eyes on Italy and Spain and France and all these European nations that if really bad things happen in Greece, we're screwed because our banks aren't just American banks. Our banks have tons of money in Europe. All that money that hasn't been staying in the United States because interest rates are so low has been going to Europe because they've been offering higher interest rates. So a catastrophe happening there is catastrophic for our markets as well. And that's absolutely going to have a profound effect on our economy. It's just a question of how wide and deep that problem is. Unfortunately, I'm not hugely optimistic. I think if you're looking to sell your home, you probably, if you're in one of these areas where things are just bloated, you probably want to do it now. Another bit of news from Housing Wire, Yellen reiterates rates likely to increase this year. I just don't see it happening. The minute they increase interest rates, the stock market is going to go down. And that is the last thing that they want to have happen. Interest rates are vitally important. There's really no sexy stuff from this particular article. It's just Janet Yellen reaffirming in a speech to her, the City Club of Cleveland, that she still expects it will be appropriate later this year to take the first step to raise federal funds rate and begin normalizing monetary policy. But she wants to emphasize that the course of the economy and inflation remains highly uncertain and unanticipated developments could delay or accelerate this first step. So I don't know. The Fed is really not firmly in control of what's going on. Some other numbers to consider. Sacramento housing in June, sales up 22%, inventory down 10%. So, I mean, none of these things are going in the direction they should be going. We'll continue to see prices getting tweaked in the wrong direction, in the up direction as inventory goes down. But the number of buyers, even if the number of buyers just stays constant, right? You reduce the inventory of a thing by 10%, and there's fewer to choose from, right? So buyers who are out there looking on, and today when they did their search last week, they saw 10 homes come up in the search. This week they only saw 9. So that means more folks per house are interested in potentially buying it. That artificially drives up prices. Not artificially. I mean, that's the supply and demand equation, right? Nothing really sexy in the data to share beyond sort of that general observation. Also wanted to share with you the 10 best housing markets for growth and stability. Number one, Boulder, Colorado. Over the past 25 years, home prices have grown on an average of 4% a year in Boulder and are approaching a price level nearly quadruple that of 1990. During that time, home prices have never once seen a decline of more than 5% in Boulder, not even during the national foreclosure crisis. That stability means homeowners in Boulder have been spared the stress of a plummeting market while still reaping the benefits of price appreciation. Austin, Texas, one that has come up on our radar multiple times, particularly the community of Round Rock, just north of Austin. Austin housing market is among the hottest in the country, but unlike many other hot markets, Austin isn't recovering from a major bust. While many cities such as San Jose and Seattle saw price declines of over 10% during the housing crisis, in Austin, prices declined by just 3.4% in that time. Those relatively minor declines were more than compensated for during the rest of the past 2.5 decades. According to data from FHFA, home prices in Austin have climbed 242% since 1990. Bismarck, North Dakota. North Dakota's economy has consistently been among the strongest in the country over the past 3 decades. The state's currently seasonally adjusted unemployment rate is just 2.6%. That economic stability also helps lead to stability in the housing market, even during hard times. This is the link between low unemployment and a more robust real estate marketplace. What did we see in Texas all during this time? Huge amounts of job growth in Texas. That's why it was number 2 on this list. I can't tell you anything about what's going on with jobs in Boulder, Colorado, but I'll bet you their unemployment rate is way below the national average. Midland, Texas. This West Texas city has had among the highest overall growth rates in its housing market over the past 25 years, with prices increasing by an average of 3.3% annually, while the city's economy has historically been driven by the local oil industry. In recent years, that hasn't led to the booms and busts typical of many oil towns. Casper, Wyoming. Second largest city in Wyoming, Casper's economy has expanded in recent decades as the region's coal and uranium fields have been developed. I had no idea they got uranium from Casper, Wyoming. I've always wanted to go to Wyoming and just sort of wander around. I like the idea of Wyoming. I don't know why. Likewise, the city's population has grown significantly over the past 30 years. That combination of economic and population growth have led to the highest average home appreciation of any U.S. city over the past 25 years. Home prices in Casper have increased 320% since 1990, an average of 4.7% annually. Anchorage, Alaska, the largest city in the last frontier, has remained largely untouched by the housing market swings that have affected much of the lower 48 states over the past 2.5 decades. While the city has seen annual average growth of over 3% since 1990, it has not suffered any significant price declines over that same period. That, in general, means more equity and less stress for Anchorage homeowners. Billings, Montana, also on my list. It's Wyoming. It's a Wyoming-Montana love fest I'm kind of interested in. I'd love to visit both of those states and spend some time. And I'm almost sure, I think I spent some time in Billings, Montana when I did a little road trip from Colorado back to California and loved the town, loved the house. They had some awesome, old architecture in Billings. I actually drove around and looked at a few houses while we were there. I loved the town. I thought it was fantastic. Someone was telling me that the wind always blows from the west and that drives people insane. No idea why that would be the case. Even during the recession of the last decade, the economy in Montana's largest city never really faltered. The unemployment rate in Billings never exceeded 7%, with most people in the city retaining their jobs. Foreclosure rates remained relatively low, and the housing market in Billings saw relatively minimal price declines. On average, homeowners in Billings had zero odds of seeing their home value decline by 5% if they bought at any point in the last 25 years. Walla Walla, Washington is number 8, is located in the southeast corner of Washington State in one of the state's most productive winemaking regions. I like that. There's a good vibe in wine communities. Growth in the local winemaking industry has bolstered the economy in recent years and sent the housing market to new heights. Home prices have grown nearly 30% since the start of 2005. Let's see. Odessa, Texas. Lots of Texas here, man. It's hard to argue. This is the fourth community in Texas. On average, a homeowner buying in Odessa over the past 25 years has faced just 4% odds of seeing price declines of 5% or greater. Compare that to cities like Las Vegas and Atlanta, where the odds of such declines since 1990 were 41% and 39% respectively. But it isn't just stability in Odessa's housing market. Home prices have consistently increased there as well. Price levels today are more than triple what they were in 1990. Houma, Thibodaux, Louisiana. Sorry. Louisiana is not a state I want to live in. Home prices in the Houma-Thibodaux region have grown nearly uninterrupted since 1990. In fact, despite the multiple setbacks of Hurricane Katrina and the recession, home prices declined by just 2.5% from their peak at the beginning of the crisis to their low point. That combined with the average annual price growth of, okay, I don't even know where that area is, so I really can't comment on that. But those are the 10 best housing markets for growth and stability. A few surprises on there. Boulder surprised me. Austin did not. Bismarck surprised me. Midland didn't surprise me. I wonder how much of this is related to natural gas stuff. That would be kind of an interesting stat to have. What else have we got? Six ways to lower your mortgage payment. Let's see. Was there anything sexy in here? Refinance at a lower interest rate. Shop around for homeowners insurance. This is something you should actually do every year and see if you can't get a better homeowners insurance rate. Grieve your tax bill. I have several former clients who ask me for a market analysis of their home every year so that they can argue their tax bill. I do it about every other year, but there's usually a cost associated with petitioning. I think it's a $40 filing fee for the form to petition for to grieve your tax bill. Make an extra mortgage payment each year. This is a great one. I actually do this a little bit differently. I just tack on a little bit of an extra amount of money to my monthly so that at the end of the year, it equates to at least one extra mortgage payment. I strongly advise doing this if you have the ability to do so. This is also something that is a fundamental strategy for me on investment properties. I prefer to overpay on my mortgages for investment properties to reduce the time I have to hold that paper. Recast your mortgage. Rich Zito, co-founder of Flynn Zito Capital Management in Garden City, New York, says, if you like your bank, you can ask to recast your loan at a lower rate. He said it depends on the bank and other factors, but it's worth looking into. Eliminate PMI insurance. This is a big one. If your original down payment was less than 20% and you've probably paid PMI insurance, but if you have more than 20% equity in the home, you no longer need PMI insurance and you can petition the bank to eliminate it. And you know what? I don't even know if they still do this. Because the process to petition to get that eliminated is rigged. It's going to be related to a appraisal, and appraisals are always ridiculously low, some and more in some areas than others. Given the very low sales, you're not going to have enough volume of properties to base an appraisal on in a lot of areas. So that's actually tough to get done. A better way to go, if you can get your loan set up originally so that bank number one is only loaning you 80%, whatever amount you need over that, you get a second loan, right? It costs you a little bit more, but it's based relating to PMI, but it really depends on how long you're paying PMI. If you can pay off that second loan faster, then that works out great for you. You end up saving an awful lot of money, and you never have to jump through the hoops of dealing with reducing the PMI with your bank because they've only loaned 80%. You've simply got this second loan that's costing you more. And as soon as that second loan is paid off, you're good. So let's say you go ahead and get that 80% loan from a bank so you don't have PMI. And then you get a second loan and particularly if the amount's relatively low, if the amount's say $10,000. And of course, I use a number like that. And in some parts of the country, that's probably a ridiculously high amount of money. But if you're just paying that off at $100 a month, I mean, there's whatever you're paying it off at, if you can add more to it to get it paid off, it absolutely ends up being worth it for you. Do the math. I mean, you can sit there with your financial person. I'm not even sure if this is still available. I haven't had a client do one of these, God, in a heck of a long time. So I'm not even sure there's a product out there that does it. But I know when I got a loan back in 99, I did this and I paid off that second in, I think, 18 months, 2 years, somewhere in that ballpark, but just really aggressively took every extra dime I had and put it into that so I could get rid of it. But it ended up working out great for me, so hopefully it could work out great for you. Don't need that story anymore. San Francisco exhibiting potential signs of a housing bubble. We talked about that one. Here are the hottest 20 housing markets in America right now. Yeah, this stuff's crazy. Lots of California on this list. San Francisco, Oakland, Hayward, California is number one. Vallejo, Fairfield, California is number 2. Denver, Aurora, Lakewood in Colorado is number 3. Santa Rosa, California is number 4. Dallas, Fort Worth, Arlington, Texas is number 5. San Jose, Sunnyvale, Santa Clara, number 6. And that's far more my area. I don't do anything in San Francisco, Oakland, or Hayward, but I do do business in San Jose, Sunnyvale, Santa Clara, and that's number 6. Lots and lots of businesses up there. Ann Arbor, Michigan is number 7. That kind of blows me away. Boston, Cambridge, Newton, Massachusetts, New Hampshire is number 8. Detroit, Warren, Dearborn is number 9. Why the hell is Detroit hot? I don't know anything about that. Santa Cruz, Watsonville, one of my old stomping grounds, is number 10. Love Santa Cruz. I lived in Aptos, which is just south of Santa Cruz, for a long time. Sacramento, Roseville, Arden, Arcade. I used to live up near Auburn, which is just north of Roseville. That's number 11. San Diego, Carlsbad. Love that area. Number 12. Fargo, North Dakota. Number 13. Billings, Montana. Again, making the list. So we saw previously. Number 14. Columbus, Ohio. 15. Stockton, Lodi, California. 16. Midland, Texas. More Texas. 17. Austin, Round Rock, Texas. 18. San Antonio, New Braunfels, Texas. 19. Fort Wayne, Indiana. 20. Cool stuff. And here are the top 10 rental markets for real estate investors. Number 10, Raleigh, North Carolina. I can't remember. I think I've been to Raleigh, but it's been a super long time. Nashville, Tennessee is number 9. I've been there. Beautiful town. 8, Charleston, South Carolina. I like Charleston. It's a little bit too humid for me, but I like Charleston. Number 7, San Antonio, Texas. In terms of humid cities, San Antonio is one I will avoid at all costs. No, thank you very much. Number 6, Orlando, Florida. Number 5, Seattle, Washington. Number 4, Austin, Texas. I love Austin. I love Lake Travis. It keeps things cooler. I could definitely do Austin. Number 3, Houston, Texas. Still too hot. Number 2, Dallas, Texas. Still too hot. Number 1, Denver, Colorado. Love Denver. So number 1 on the list I could absolutely do. And what else have we got? I actually think that's it. I managed to cover every article I had pulled aside there. So that's really it this week, folks. I may do a bit more of an in-depth show relating to the vacation rental thing where I talk about the tools I use for the website, how I take payments, what I like about it, what I don't like about it. You know, just because I'm getting more people contacting me directly about what's going on. One of the most common messages I got over the last couple of weeks was, hey, give me an update on what's going on with your vacation rental experience. I get a feeling there's some sort of demand for that, but then I get some other people who say couldn't care less about the vacation rental thing. So maybe to satisfy everybody, I split those off into two separate kind of streams of thought, and we can talk about those separately. Still have things left on today's to-do list to do with the vacation rental and a couple of other things. So I'm going to go ahead and sign off and jump into those. If you'd like to get in contact with me, there are a variety of ways to do that. The best way is to head on over to my website at www.soldbyrobert.com. You can also head on over to www.therebelbroker.com. And now you can go over to robertsrentals.us if you're interested in taking a look at my vacation rental located on the windward side of Oahu. It's a beautiful spot. I've got the latest photos posted. So if you want to take a look at what I've done, head on over and see what you think. I appreciate you taking the time to listen to what I have to say on these subjects. And I super appreciate the patience of those of you who live through the periods of silence. I do. Yeah, I'm going to do what I can do. I'm working on trying to get more time. You know how things are. Things can be tough. So anyway, thanks again. And I'll talk to y'all next week.